Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, regular listeners, you may have spotted that we've changed our name. It's now Honey & Co. The Food Sessions.
So if you hear this sound, it's just us making dinner.
Well, that and the fact that we're not allowed to use our old title anymore.
It's just been a bit of a thing, but don't worry about it.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Sarit Becker.
I'm Itamar Sulovic. Together we run a couple of Middle Eastern restaurants in London.
And we also do our fair share of food writing.
You're listening to Honey & Co., where we take turns interviewing interesting people from the world of food in front of a small audience at our deli, Honey & Spice.
In this series, we'll be meeting producers and makers who create some of the essential ingredients in cooking.
The people you're going to hear from supply us, inspire us, improve our cooking and our life in general.
We hope you enjoy and have fun geeking out with us about all things food.
Enjoy.
This evening we were joined by Ben McKinnon from E5 Bakehouse in East London in Hackney. It's a great bakery. It does everything from breads to breakfast to cakes and cookies. Absolutely fascinating place. We talked about sourdough, we talked about ancient grains, we talked about flour, about old processes, new processes. It's absolutely fascinating. It's the subject that I'm most passionate about. Have a listen. Ben started the bakery, or started baking bread, at 2011, initially delivering to 20 households using a friend's pizza oven. And then the business has grown. They now have three arches, and they're renowned for their sourdough. Please help me in welcoming Ben.
Thank you.
Itamar and I came not that long ago to, well, maybe, you know, in our life.
Very recently,
to the bakery, and we had a walk around. But I don't know if anyone here has been, but for definitely people on the podcast, can you give us like a description of what's going on there?
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, we're in several railway arches, and it feels a bit like an Aladdin's den, because you walk into a very small front cafe, and beyond is the baker's oven to your left, behind a shelf filled with different breads. And beyond that is the lunch kitchen, and further back still are the team of bakers making the bread. So that's the original arch, and then running off on one side we have a kind of hidden arch, which is where the cakes and the pastries are made. And then to the right is our newest acquisition, the mill house as we call it, and that's a kind of an arch that you can walk through. It's got a big silo on one side, and it's got a glass room with a French stone mill, which is purring away, grinding flour. And on top are more small hoppers, they're called, these stainless steel bins filled with grain. And around that, you've got tables and chairs and a breakfast kitchen and a backyard full of trees and flowers where people can also spend time, especially at this time of year.
Yeah, so basically you really want to go. And the only reason I don't go more is because I'm in South London and it's like takes forever to get there. But it's a really amazing place and kind of a hive of activity. And like you say, in the center of it is these kind of bread ovens and where people are mixing the doughs. And I want to start from the beginning. Sourdough, how does this happen? Sourdough loaf. This is your beautiful one that you're
it's
very famous
beautiful.
For.
It's a beautiful. We're looking at a loaf called the Hackney Wild. Really good bread is made of flour, water, and salt. And all of those things should be as well sourced as possible in order to make that bread. And then fermenting it is using natural yeasts and bacteria. So what we have is a leaven, a sourdough starter, which is simply a sort of batter made up of flour and water. And within that are the wild yeast. So where does it begin? Well, it probably began as a sort of accident. that somebody had a sort of a porridge in a pot, and it began to ferment naturally. So those yeasts and bacteria that are in there have all arrived on the grain or in the air, and they are specific to sort of fermenting flour.
Do you remember what you did? You start your first ferment from just flour and water, because ours, for example, in Honey and Smoke, is started with organic raisins. Mm. So we make like a kind of organic raisin wine. We let that ferment, then we mix it flour. Yeah. So it's kind of got a bit of a tanginess. But did you start
Indeed.
With a plain?
Well, we have two starters on the go. We did have two origins for the starters.
Yeah.
So way back in spring of 2010, I went on a short 1 week course at the School of Artisan Food. And during that week, we started day one of 5 days. We mixed our flour and water, and we did indeed put in some raisins.
Yeah.
Golden rule is, after the 5 days, take your raisins out, because if you leave them in there for too long, they get a bit funky.
Yeah.
So we kept that
and
one going.
And they have
going.
To be organic. No,
of course they have to be organic, yeah. And don't use any sort of heavy duty chemical sprays in your kitchen. You know, this is something so alive. And the other sourdough starter was given to us by a girl who popped into the bakery, and she explained she was heading back to Sweden to see her family and could bring me a rye starter. So we didn't have one at the time, and I thought, great. And in due course, she explained that starter had a 200-year-old history, and you know, their family have always remembered who it came from before them. And this isn't uncommon. You know, theoretically, starters can keep going. Generally, when people think they're not doing too well, they've still got, you know, dormant yeast and bacteria that can be kick-started.
You can bring them back to life sometimes.
You can generally bring them back.
Have you lost any of your strains from the start? Have you had to restart?
Indeed, exactly. Yeah. So we're now dependent on that 200-year-old one, apparently. And who knows if it's 200 years old, but it's a good story.
Ours is just and, 3 years.
And so just to dip into the science again, you know, what's going on with that flour and water? It's a little bit like if you imagine the grain of wheat getting water on it and beginning to germinate. The young plant needs sugar to grow, so there's enzymes within the endosperm, the sort of starchy powerhouse of the grain, enzymes like amylase and maltase that begin to convert the starch into sugar, and it's that the yeast and bacteria feed on. So one of the reasons it's called sourdough, or the reason actually it's called sourdough, is that the bacteria, the lactic and acetic bacteria, converting those sugars into organic acids. And I don't know masses about the sort of health properties, but it's a kind of pre-digestion, a bacterial pre-digestion that happens very conveniently outside of our body and is therefore much better for us to enjoy.
So once you've taken this sourdough starter, you mix it into, I'm assuming, much more flour.
We do.
And then salt?
Yeah, so the simple process is generally at the beginning of a morning we'll refresh the sourdough starter. At the end of the day we'll refresh it again, we'll leave it overnight, and now it's ready to go into the dough the next morning. So the dough comes together and we spend 5-6 hours sort of allowing that dough to ferment and stretching it, shaping it, and then putting it into usually a banneton, but in the case of this loaf here, we're kind of free-forming it in a couche, this kind of floured linen that allows the dough to rise, and then we do a retarded fermentation. So it's not essential, but the different types of bacteria favour different sort of environments. So acetic bacteria favours the cold, so we put them in at about 5 or 6 degrees.
By that's retarded, you mean slow? Because you may have to explain to
some people that don't do
baking.
So this retarded fermentation, bit of a techie word, just throwing it out there to sort of feel like we're a bit more professional. And that means we can all go to bed. And if you're making sourdough at home and you haven't come across this use of the fridge, it changes everything. It allows a lot of flexibility in your sort of bread making process.
Yeah. And you don't add any additives or preservatives? Do you have any assisted raising agents, anything like that in your breads?
No, we don't. The bakehouse and sort of my entry into it was founded on sort of how to put the ethics that I wanted to work within and devote myself to into practice. So I'd worked within natural resources management and sustainability for a long time, and I saw and found bread as a really direct route to applying that. For example, we deliver by bicycle, we use renewable energy, and then our ingredients can be as ethical as possible. So we started using organic flour milled in Essex, which is 20 or so miles away from the bakery. So job done on that front, let's kind of get on to other things. And as we inquired a bit about where the flour came from, we began to discover that it wasn't as straightforward as it seemed. So 80% of organic flour used in the UK comes from overseas, typically Kazakhstan or the Ukraine, Canada, Germany. Am I getting ahead?
No, you're getting ahead, but it's a very important point, and it's fine because I'll ask you about it anyway.
It's going to come back around to kind of what you asked about additives.
But I think this fact about so much of the flour being imported is a huge thing that people aren't aware of in this country, and really a place should have pride in its own growth or what it can produce. And I think, well, part of the reasons I think where some of the allergies are coming through and stuff like that is by using flours that aren't so local to here.
Well, indeed, yeah. Well, that's what I asked. I said, so why can't we use the British flour? And they said it's not good for bread. British flour doesn't make good bread. I thought, well, really? You know, surely I grew up in surrounded by fields, actually, in a county called Suffolk, and I was a bit baffled. So we did the obvious thing, and to us at the time, which was buy a small flour mill and some grain from an organic farmer and try it. And
I'm going to interrupt him again, but when Ben says it was natural to him, when we came to the bakery, for Itamar and me, our mind was blown, because it would be like my biggest dream to be able to... I've stopped eating flour, actually, as my day-to-day, because I've developed so many like allergies to it only in this country. When I go back home to Israel and I eat the local bread, I'm completely fine. And we've traveled all around the Middle East and I'm completely fine with bread there. As soon as I eat bread in this country, I react really badly to it. So I've completely stopped eating it here. And when we saw the mill and these, we'll talk a bit in a bit about these original grains, but all this aspect of being able to use grains that were local, and I straight away want to test it on me and see if it makes me, you know, feel bad. Everything we bake today, by the way, is from different kind of grains, which we'll discuss in a second.
E5
has been a big part of the sourdough revival, and it has had a revival, because when I first moved here, I don't remember seeing sourdough anywhere, really. And now it's pretty much everywhere, and most places try and make their own and stuff like that. But can we talk a bit about why it went out of fashion, or why people stopped selling it as such?
I mean, there's been two ways of leavening bread historically. There's been using a sourdough leaven, and there's been using the barm from beer. So, you know, if you happen to be in a place that makes a lot of beer, often the barm was scooped off. And the alternative is the leaven approach, which happened a lot more in France, for example. My understanding is where we really began to industrialize bread. I mean, sourdough had lost its sort of dominance for you know, a good 100 or 200 years, really, in the UK. But it was around World War II when we had, you know, such food poverty that all the investment, all the advice, all the sort of government agencies were looking to reduce food costs and make food more affordable to the general public. And that coincided with a process called the Chorleywood bread making process, which was the mechanization and industrialization that saw the ability to make loaves in less than an hour from start to finish. And these were the sort of squishy, plump, you know, deliciously white sort of wrapped loaves that you know, there's nothing as good as sliced white. It came at a time of an agricultural revolution off the back of these great wars, where the chemical industries that had been making the chemicals for the bombs now understood that the very same things could be used to grow food in far greater volume. So we suddenly had this sort of we were awash with these higher yields. We had this sort of industrial method of making bread, and the market was just flooded with incredibly cheap bread that kind of hit a lot of, you know, the sort of points that people were looking for. You know, it was sugary, it was white, it was
cheap, which
fundamentally
is probably, you know,
you know, the main cost. People have often said over the years, like, oh, you're spending more on your flour. It's like, well, the cost isn't, you know, when you're making artisan bread, the cost isn't necessarily in the flour. It's much more in the other parts, particularly the labor.
The labor, the time,
yeah,
as well,
the time,
everything
the
like
time,
that. Yeah,
the time, the space, that's it.
And then, this, like I said, there's been this changeover and or
revitalization.
Exactly,
or
that's, you know,
yeah.
Good. Well, let Ben talk from now.
I think it's a revival
yeah.
Yeah.
Of sourdough. And so what do you think has caused that on the other side of the...
Well, E5, as I say, sort of kicked off around 2010, and you know, I was living in Hackney and built this clay oven in a railway arch, and people were really excited. And you know, this coincided with the big economic recession that we had, you know, off the back of 2008. And I think it was a time when people were going, hang on, you know, it's not all about spending money, buying, you know, going on fancy things. What's real? What's tangible? And a loaf of bread really symbolises that, I think. So that was one reason. I think as well in the UK we've been getting more and more food conscious and considering these supply chains, considering the quality of food. And
also there's a lot more pride in making, isn't there? In like...
the craft. Taking
a, yeah, in craft in general. It. I think there's a lot more interest in people producing pots and, you know, 100%. Everything like that. And food, in a way, becomes part of that.
And the community where E5 is, we're very supportive of seeing something being made within the community, that sort of direct supply chain where they could feel that where they were putting their money was, you know, within the community, and they were supporting something small scale and that was making a product that, however good it was, the people who are making it really, really care about it and, you know, are invested in it and passionate about it. So,
how many loaves would you think you kind of make in a day at E5? It probably changes quite a bit during the week,
doesn't
it?
Yeah, between Monday and Friday, it doubles. So we make 500 on a quiet day and 1,000 on a busy day.
Wow. Yeah. It's a fair bit of bread, isn't it?
It's a fair bit of bread, yeah. But, you know, it's also not, as I mentioned, we only deliver by bicycle. We haven't changed our production for about 5 years, really. So we're just sort of staying at that level.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And then let's go back to this original grain and your interest in it, because you've kind of taken this even a step further and you've actually taken a small holding where you grow some of the things. And again, this is something that I'm completely fascinated by. So how did all of this come about?
I guess it was something dormant inside me that I was like excited to do, and began to sort of have a feeling that was the next step personally and for the company as well. One of the sort of avenues that the company was taking, to go back to the sort of sourcing the UK wheat. So we went to these farmers and we said, can we get some wheat? And we began to play with it. And then we learned that there was modern wheat and old wheat. So the modern wheats, in a simple way, are very short, yeah? So they were developed around this time of this agricultural green revolution in the 40s, 50s. A guy called Norman Borlaug, who is very famous in the sort of crop breeding world, and he developed this very short wheat, which meant that when you applied nitrogen and other fertilizers that caused the old wheats to grow even taller, and then they would surely fall down in the field in any wind and rain, these short ones stood up to it. We saw much more ownership of seed around that time, to the point that, you know, a handful of companies, as probably the audience know, you know, dominate the supply and sale of seed and its development. So in the UK, if you're an organic farmer, you choose from, say, three varieties of wheat to grow, milling wheat. And every year or two, a new one will come on and one will go off the list. And you tend, farmers tend to keep up with the latest stuff because it offers a bit of better disease resistance against fungus or pest or competing plants and so on. But when you're not using chemicals in a system, for example, herbicides, the competition from weeds is that much more. And so these short wheats are actually a major disadvantage because the competing weeds grow up above them and shade out the light, or rather the wheat doesn't shade them out, so there's a lot more competition. At the same time, we're not applying fungicides. So, you know, if there's genetic diversity, great, but if there's not, if there's just one or two species, these funguses spread around and decimate the crop. So we quite quickly saw, well, this doesn't make a huge amount of sense. And so we began to meet characters like Andy Forbes of Brockwell Bake, who were, in Andy's case, he's growing a bunch of heritage wheats on an allotment in Brockwell. And when he finds ones that make good bread, and this guy was a pioneer on the London bread scene. I mean, he was peddling his breads around Brixton, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Really great sourdough. So when he found a good one, he began to go out to farmers and ask them to grow it. And he's still doing a lot with the Brockwell Bake Association. So we'd spend time in the pub and I had no idea what he was talking about, especially after two or three pints. But something, a seed was, you know, germinated within me. And I just felt intrinsically right. And so about six, seven years ago, a group of us bakers from E5 went to Denmark, and an old friend of mine, his cousin's a chef, and she arranged a kind of tour for us. And this old friend's father is an organic farmer there. So as part of the tour, we got to meet, we got kind of connected with this guy called Per Grupa. He had an Irish guy working with him, running the farm they have. So we turned up one morning and he said, okay guys, we've got 10 different wheats we've been growing here and we're going to mill all of them and you're going to make bread with it. We didn't know anything about this. We were only there for a couple of days. So we spent the rest of the day making bread with these different old varieties of wheat, and we put them to prove overnight, and we came back the next morning and baked them. And we did a load of other fun stuff. But it was somehow a pivotal moment, and it was around the time of getting a little bit of land in Suffolk. So we said, Per, can we have some of your wheat? And he said, yes. So he sent us some 500 kilos of Lee Sprun in the post. And yeah, we put it in, a local farmer planted it in our field, and it was the first crop that worked. So the first year we grew oats, and it turns out there's such a thing as hulled oats and naked oats. And we grew the hulled ones, which are the best for porridge. But there's nowhere that does small-scale de-hulling. So I did finally find somebody, but we only got like 85% of the hulls off. And when you eat a bowl of porridge with 15% hulls, you don't want to do it. The next year we grew a modern wheat, and we had a disaster with it. So, you know, this wheat worked really well. And
so it's a lot of playing around, isn't it?
Playing around.
I think the best flour I've had was from Denmark, actually. I wonder if it's the same guy. I can't remember the name because I'm really bad at it. But anyway, it was amazing organic flour, really beautiful. So there's also advantages to the soil, though, isn't there, in planting different varieties of wheat and rotating things around in terms of giving some nutrients back. Are you doing any crop rotation on your small holding, anything like that?
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. I mean, one of the other striking things about these heritage varieties, as they're often called, which are this sort of tall straw wheats, is corresponding to their height, they have equally deep roots. And so those deeper roots can scavenge and draw up things that the shorter plants couldn't do. So they're much more robust. They work well in these systems. So there's a few things that I'm really excited about at the moment. There's a movement in France called the Boulanger Paysan movement, which I think you'd be interested to hear about. It's in France, the rules to be a baker are very strict. You have to go to bakery school for something like 7 years, and then often you have to take over an existing bakery, and that bakery will be tied to a mill. It will be in a kind of tie to this mill, which sucks if you want to do something a bit punk. So there's this kind of alternative group called Boulanger Paysan, and they have got around this by growing the wheat that they use in their bread, and they in turn mill it. So a pioneer of that, Nicolas Houpio, I've spent some time learning with him. He runs courses, so I did a course with him, and he takes you into the fields. In one system he has is that he grows camelina, which is it's called the weed of wheat in Scandinavia, where it it is, a kind of weed of wheat. It's a brassica. It makes an oil, camelina oil. There's a company called Hobmadods who have been featured on this podcast before, and they actually sell the camelina seed. It's amazing in crisp breads, if you or any bread, but particularly in crisp breads, it brings a really interesting sort of nuttiness. So he grows the camelina, and he grows field beans as well, which he feeds to the cattle, who are kind of part of his integrated system. That's something I really want to try, because what he does is he doesn't rotate. By having the camelina and the peas, they all mature at the same time, and he can plant the same thing the next year, and maybe every 4 or 5 years he has a fallow year and he goes back in. He's a big believer. He has a lot of oak trees around his farm, you know, his forest or whatever, which leads me on to this other method of farming, which is really gaining traction, it feels now. You know, DEFRA are beginning to look at it as a sort of option for funding in the future, sort of in the future. Agroforestry. So what we're doing is putting a lot more trees into the arable context. So we're planting avenues of trees, and then we have alleys of crops. And that brings a lot of benefits. So that's like heavy duty companion planting. It creates a microclimate, so you get less sort of disruption from wind. It stabilizes rainfall, so rather than having kind of floods or droughts, it regulates that much better. Of course, the leaves add organic matter, and the roots bring up nutrients from below. It buffers pests and diseases and adds a lot of biodiversity. And on some of the fields that we're managing, we're looking this autumn to start planting, and we'll probably do it incrementally over the years. And the kind of species we're looking at are walnut and cobnut.
So then you could also use all of those in the bakery as well.
And potentially interplanting with flowers like lavender, but you know, early days. But that's one thing. The more traditional organic rotation or traditional rotations are sort of
it's broad beans, isn't it?
Beans, there's a lot of beans. Exactly. You go for beans to bring the nitrogen with the roots, and then barley and wheat and so on. But you know, really the more diverse and the longer the rotations, the better. Unless, you know, there's this model that I've suggested. One of the motivations for, you know, having a go at farming, let's say, is because it's on micro scale. It's just to be able to stand in the field and have those conversations with the farmers and feel a little bit like we're kind of cutting our teeth and learning firsthand how to do things. We certainly aren't, you know, doing the whole lot. We work with a lot with contractors. And also we're commissioning more and more farmers to grow varieties on our behalf. So, for example, the wheat in this bread here is made up in part of a variety called Åland, which is perhaps the one that you tried in Denmark before. It was found, a lot of these old wheats were kind of found, you know, I'm sure this one was found in a suitcase or something, in an old sauna, and on an island called Åland off Denmark. I don't know.
What do you think regular people, consumers can do to encourage more of this exploration of grain? Is there anything that can be done properly by people? How can we avoid supermarket full of additive flours? What's the way forward for us?
Well, personally, we're at this sort of major occasion, I feel, in humanity's history, where we're, you know, especially, you know, in London, we're really opening our eyes to how quick the effects of climate change are likely to be felt and how rapidly biodiversity is depleting. So from an ecological point of view, I feel like we need to be making the point for our food choices. Farmers have been disregarded and disengaged for so long. Like, wheat is a commodity that comes off the farm in 29-ton lorries and goes, you know, they don't know where. And I feel like by reviving their sort of spirit and engaging them in the process, it's really exciting. So really it's about shortening supply chains. You know, there's a handful of mills in this country. There used to be tens of thousands. You know, of course, there's pros and cons and arguments for both. But personally, I feel that by shortening supply chains, we have a lot more traceability, a lot more handle over it, and there's a lot more sort of good feeling and engagement within that chain.
And the flowers are, they're different. They react differently. So I've baked quite a bit of stuff today and tried to keep it into a bit of different things. I've used two types of flour from Ben. One is Edgar. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit kind of on the variety. Where is it from? Mm. What is it?
Sure. So that Edgar flour is farmed by a guy called John Turner in Northamptonshire. So it's a small, also organic farm. He has a bit of cattle in the rotation. The Edgar is, I think, a wheat from about the 1970s. So it's not a classically an old variety, mm-hmm. but becomes a pastry flour. And
yeah, well, I made the shortbreads with it today, awesome. Which you're going to try a bit later. And I made the batter for the chicken with it.
The difference between a pastry and a bread flour is largely in protein content. So when we talk about proteins in flour, we're largely talking about the gluten. You talked about reactions to flour. What wheat breeders have been focusing on over the last 70 years or more is gluten to a large degree, as well as yield, but gluten has been a big thing, and the range of glutens has really narrowed. So glutens are made up of gliadins and glutens, there's hundreds of them, but that spectrum has really shifted. So the modern wheats tend to be in a very narrow spectrum. The older wheats are much harder for bakers to work with to achieve the kind of results they might be aiming for or have expected. So in order to shift to this, you know, to using the kind of wheats that I believe are important for our sort of ecosystem, it takes a bit of rethinking what the loaf should look like and how it should behave. But it's fun, you know, it's really fun working with that flour. And when we're stone milling, we're not stripping away the germ, which is the yolk of an egg, for example. So the germ in the wheat grain contains all of those oils and vitamins and minerals that the baby plant needs. In roller milling, which is where all of our flour generally comes from, that germ's separated because it can go rancid, it's sort of alive. And we also get the particles of bran coming through depending on the sieve size, and the type of mill being used. But the pastry flour, yeah, it's largely the protein content and the types of protein being used.
Are any of these breads made with it, or are they all
No, so they're stronger? Made, well, largely, yeah, we've got a rye bread, that sort of oblong tin loaf with the sesame seeds is a Danish rye with walnuts and some treacle and so on in. And then we've got the Hackney Wild and the Stockholm. Both are actually made with the same mix, but just cooked in different ways. So the Stockholm's cooked in a hotter oven, and it's not shaped. It's kind of cut as a free-form loaf and then loaded off the peel into the oven. But the Stockholm and the Hackney Wild have three types of flour. They have the Orland, which came from Scotland the Bread. Scotland the Bread is an initiative set up by Andrew Whitley, who I know I'm probably overloading you a tiny bit now, but just hear me out for one last thing. So Andrew Whitley is this guy who started the Real Bread campaign, which check it out if you have time. It's a fantastic organisation, a bit like the campaign for Real Ale. And it's doing its best to promote and challenge the sort of anti-real bread campaign, you know, that supermarkets and the like might begin to prophesize. So Andrew Whitley had a bakery in the north of England, and more recently a bread school in the borders of Scotland. And he's now sort of championing and growing old varieties of wheat that used to be grown in Scotland. Scotland doesn't grow any of its own bread wheat, none. Yet it grows tons of wheat. And by changing things and growing the wheat there and having smaller bakeries, there'd be a huge economic shift up there, you know? So that's one of the things he's doing. Yeah.
It's interesting to see where it all goes. The second flour I used was the Lisbrun,
yeah.
Which I made the danishes that you had earlier with the butternut and feta, and then the little kind of mini date and orange cakes with a bit of marzipan that you will eat for dessert. It's interesting. I love this. I love seeing it react completely differently to what our regular, we use a Shipton Mill strong flour as our kind of milk bun dough. And here I've done two things that are quite different with it, and it reacts very differently. And I love that. I think it's part of the enjoyment is playing with those kind of things. You teach a lot of people how to bake as well, no? You have courses
That's
in
right.
E5,
yeah? We started teaching just, you know, inviting people into the bakery and sharing what we're doing early on. Yeah.
Guys, you should go. If you want to see more information about E5 Bakehouse, check it out online. Amazing website. It's really interesting.
I don't want you to downplay your flour. I mean, Shipton Mill is a really great mill. They started off, John Lister, who started it, took over a defunct mill in Gloucestershire, an old stone mill, in fact, and got it going again.
No, I think, I think it's a very good,
and they're very forward thinking as well, and so on. So they're definitely on the right side, and it's great flour. I mean, with the Lisbrun that you've used there, that is an older variety, and that's the one that Per sent us from Denmark. Mm-hmm. And I kind of asked about the origins of that, and it came out of some sort of, it's a combination of several different plants. It's not just one species. There's a number of different species within there, and they look stunning in the field, guys. I can't tell you, like, you know, compared to a field of modern wheat, which is so sort of, at this time a month or so ago, that it looks so weird and blue in the field, and then it just looks like what it is, a monoculture. This field has the spiky awns on the wheat, a lot of them, Some are a bit shorter, some are a bit taller, some have droopy heads, some stand up straight. You know, there's relatives of spelt in there, much more close to spelt. It's stunning, you know. They sing when they're beginning to ripen, they sort of crackle. And anyway, but the thing about the Lee Spring I wanted to say is it does have, you know, real depth of flavour to it. It's something really quite remarkable.
The flavour is amazing, the stretch is different.
And the stretch is very different.
That's an interesting thing to play around with.
Yeah.
But indeed. You shouldn't be scared of it. Your bread shouldn't always have all the same elasticity. It does different things.
That's it.
It's fascinating. I can go on for hours. I'm not going to go on for hours. But let's thank Ben. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us. Thanks so much for listening to our latest episode. If you'd like to join one of the next talks, please follow us on social media at Honey & Co or go on our website, honeyandco.co.uk. We would really appreciate if you took some time and rated us at iTunes. Only 5 stars, please. With a huge thanks to Hester Kant for producing.
A special thanks to our own Louisa Cornford for her wonderful research.
And the music is by the lovely Alice Russell. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.